I think we've gotten to a point where we're too accepting of the fact that Tim Burton is at best this like goth kid Gen X touchstone, and at worst, whose sole purpose now is to just make crummy remakes of old movies and keep Johnny Depp employed. But like for a solid 10 years, I think Tim Burton made a lot of really good films. And Beetlejuice was to me, like I was really thinking about it. I think about this a lot, actually, like the movies that really shaped my kind of sense of humor and sense of style. And I've narrowed it down to like, he did Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which was one of them. Ghostbusters was another. We had a edited for television VHS tape of Beverly Hills Cops, Beverly Hills Cop. So think of Eddie Murphy in the 80s with no swears. That's just how I imagined his comedy was. All these things that we were, you know, if you grew up in the 80s or 90s, you thought maybe were a little bit more wholesome than they were. But Beetlejuice, it has a couple of like curse words in it throughout, but like it is kind of a weirdly, it's an adult film, but it's also like I would show it to kids if I had them, like now. It's just it's an interesting film.
Welcome to Open Form. I'm Michael Denzel Smith. The Maitlands are dead, but that part doesn't seem to bother them. What does is that the Dietzes have moved into their home and are changing everything. Naturally, they want to haunt this new family and reclaim their property, but they're going to need some help, in the form of the afterlife's most notorious poltergeist. This week's film is Beetlejuice, and it was chosen by Jason Diamond, author of Searching for John Hughes, and most recently, The Sprawl, Reconsidering the Weird American Suburbs. When you said Beetlejuice, I was like, oh man, it's been so long since I've seen Beetlejuice. But the thing is, when I watched in preparation for our conversation, I think I realized that like, oh, I've blocked out most of Beetlejuice because like the when I saw it, I was like 3 or 4, and I think my parents must have like overestimated my bravery level because like I was frightened by it, and I think I've blocked out most of Beetlejuice and was like, oh, this is unfamiliar to me as I watch this now.
Yeah, I think that was like a real thing. Maybe in the 80s. Like I remember one of the first, like the first movie I think I ever saw in a theater was Ghostbusters. And I think around that time, the next movie I remember seeing was The Goonies. And I remember being terrified to go see this movie with Ghost in the title. And then I remember all I knew about Goonies was the preview had a skull and crossbones in it, so I thought it was going to be scary. But going into Beetlejuice for some reason, maybe because I'd seen Pee-wee's Big Adventure, I probably didn't connect that it was the same director. I was like 7 years old, so never mind that. But I don't know. I just kind of knew right away, like the music when I was a kid, just like that Danny Elfman score at the start. It just kind of like felt light to me the right way. And I mean, I remember exactly where I was when I watched it. I was in a hotel in Boston because my dad, you know, he traveled a lot for work, but this one time he had to take me with him on a trip, and he just sat me in a hotel room, and I just kept renting Beetlejuice on the pay-per-view over and over, and it was like a $100 bill. And yeah, I just, you know, from the start to finish, I was just kind of very taken with it.
Are you the guys hiding out in the attic?
We're ghosts!
What do you look like under there?
Aren't you scared?
I'm not scared of sheets. Are you gross under there? Are you Night of the Living Dead under there? Like all bloody veins and pus?
Night of the what?
Living Dead, it's a movie. You know, if I had seen a ghost at your age, I would have been scared out of my wits.
So you've got here the Maitlands, Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis, this married couple who who are going on a vacation at home. Like, and that's the whole setup is, you know, then they're driving. I forget where they're going, but they just get in an accident and then they fall into the like river or something and then they die. And then we're dealing with their afterlife and the fact that a new family is moving into their home and they are not happy about this couple moving into their home. And I sense in that, like, one, it was very striking to me. It's just like when you say, like, you know, you could sense now or sense from the score, like, that it was very light, like, and not... I didn't realize that until, you know, obviously watching it for this, like, they just kind of accept death really quickly. And then, so it's, yeah, like, it does make it light. Like, and I think it's striking to think or interesting to think of, like, what the original script apparently was and, like, how dark it actually was meant to be, like, that you see, like, all the arms mangled and, like, the gruesome nature of the accident and everything, like, that was the idea. But now it's just like, okay, we're dead, like, cool, no problem. And then, like, all right, now we have to haunt these people because they're in our house.
But at first, they don't want to haunt them. I think they're kind of like, we can just live up in this attic.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it's I've always been a little fuzzy on, like, the whole, like, why they're just in the attic, like, why they have to stay in, like, a certain spot. But yeah, I think it had this, like, kind of weird, the house was so, because, I mean, I grew up in the Midwest and, you know, I always kind of had this fascination with New England.
Mm.
It just always looked so, you know, beautiful and quiet and quaint. And,
mm-hmm.
I just remember being like, oh, that's like a picture perfect New England town. I kind of like how that looks. And I think that also was sort of like a sign that this was, I mean, of course, you know, picture perfect New England, you know, is also a great setup for, like, haunted houses and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Like, there's, like, that house looks like it could be out of a Shirley Jackson story or novel. But, yeah, I don't know. It just kind of, like, it just felt right to me. Like, it doesn't really have any elements of a horror movie at the start. Like, there was mm-hmm. nothing that, because, you know, when I was a kid, when that movie came out, you know, the horror movies of the day were, like, slasher movies.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing that kind of gave me a sense that Freddy Krueger was going to pop out.
Mm-hmm.
But it also didn't feel like an outright comedy. Like, you don't really get any jokes until, I don't know how far into it, like, until Beetlejuice starts popping up, I guess.
Yeah, and I mean, Beetlejuice appears and we don't see him and we don't really understand who this character is or, like, what he's supposed to, like, he's reading the newspaper, he's, like, looking for a job as a bio exorcist and he's like, oh, these people look dumb, like, I'll like, which they're
stupid.
They are kind of stupid, right? Oh, yeah. Like, yeah. You know, he's like, they die and there's the handbook for the recently deceased and Alec Baldwin's character reads it as diseased and I'm just like, how?
Yeah, and the thing is, it's like, we don't really get enough of Beetlejuice's backstory, but he kind of has this, like, he seems like he's probably, he gives his like resume at some point. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember everything that's in it except that he'd seen The Exorcist 150 times. But I think he, like, went to, like, some really good colleges when he was alive. He has an education. He's pretty smart. And yeah, he's just kind of preying on these, like, I don't want to call them, like, dummies, but they, yeah, you're right. They're kind of not that bright.
But then he's like, he run down this resume, but he's like, as a character, he's just the ultimate dirtbag, right? Yeah. Like, he's trying to escape. What is, I wasn't clear on what that was. It was, he needs to get married for some reason.
Yeah.
And the person that he's chosen to marry is Winona Ryder's character, Lydia, who's like 14, 15. Like, you know, like, he's a real dirtbag character.
Yeah, he's pretty problematic in a lot of ways. And, I think they kind of are upfront about that. Like, he's a scumbag. But, you know, it is what I gather is he got banished, maybe?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. You know, there could have been a lot of fleshing out that this story could have used in hindsight. But, you know, that's kind of the beauty of Michael Keaton in this movie in particular. Mm. And in a lot of movies Michael Keaton's in, where he's just like, just pure, just like, you just don't know what he's driving at, but you're just like, I'm going with him. This guy's like, he does it. There's a scene in the first Batman movie where, you know, he yells like, you want to get nuts? Come on, let's get nuts. Like, yeah. That's like pure Beetlejuice to me.
You got
to
help me.
What?
Look, how much am I calling illegal alien, okay? I want out for good. In order for me to do that, hey, I got to get married. Hey, these aren't my rules. Come to think of it, I don't have any rules.
I just read, I forget the name of the book. Like, I just finished it like last week. It's the whole story of the making of Chinatown.
Mm.
And part of the reason I was thinking of Beetlejuice was because it got me thinking of how we're doing a film podcast, and I'm going to say esque, but how Nicholson-esque Michael Keaton is as Beetlejuice. Like, I could see Jack Nicholson as Beetlejuice.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Just, I could see him taking that role and just, you know, flipping it around and, yeah.
Yeah. I did think through some of this. It may be a weird leap, but go with me on this, right?
Yeah.
So I was watching this and I was like, this feels like, obviously it's lighthearted and it's comedic and all of those things, but it feels like an anxious movie in a number of ways, in that it feels like, especially the 80s, there's like an anxiety among yuppies, right? That like, yes, their idyllic life will be haunted by something else, right? And, you know, you get these folks moving in, the Dietzes. You know, they've got a goth child that's like rebelling against what their like sort of success and like her, you know, the situation with her dad marrying having a new wife, all of that. Like, she's just disconnected from all of that, but they're moving from New York City to like, he's, you know, getting this house out in the countryside and all of that, right? But what happens? The people who were there before are now trying to remove them from that, and they employ in the pursuit of that this real dirtbag, right? This complete outsider. And the solution to all of this is not like to excise part of the solution is to excise the ghost at first, right? But then the dirtbag character comes along and he scares off a lot of them, but then what they need to do is get rid of him. He's the actual problem, right? And so then they live harmoniously together, these two families, and then the child is no longer goth.
Yeah. Cured her of her gothness.
And I think of this, and like what I say, like, go with me. I thought of Scorsese's After Hours.
My favorite film. Literally, people can't see me waving my hands. And this also goes into a theory that, yes, go on, please.
But it's similar in that anxiety, right? That, like, I have this life, like, that could be disrupted, could be taken away by these weird characters, right?
Yeah.
Like, that something is afoot out here, that we have worked hard for this American dream, this idyllic situation, then the era of Reagan, all of the spoils are coming to us, and that someone out there doesn't want us to have it, but we can handle it. Don't worry. We can at some point get rid of these people.
We can pay somebody for it.
We can pay somebody for it.
Whoa!
There you go.
You don't have to kill anybody.
Ah, possession.
Good.
Learn to throw your voice. Fool your friends. Fun and party.
No, we just want to get some people out of our house.
Ah, I understand. Well, look, in order to do that, I'm really going to have to get to know you guys. You know, we got to get closer. Move in with you for a while. Get to be real pals. You know what I'm saying?
I am so happy you brought up After Hours, because it is, And whenever people are like, oh, my favorite Scorsese film is this, mine is this, I'm like, After Hours. It is. I just love that movie. I mean, also Catherine O'Hara.
Catherine O'Hara again. Genius.
Just an absolute icon. But there is this article, and I have to find it, and I'll send it to you. It came out like 7 years ago, 6 years ago. It was after B.B. King died, actually. Mm. I remember that. Because, you know, like blues music plays such a heavy part in like a lot of 80s soundtracks. Mm-hmm. Like you hear like, even if it's not B.B. King, it's like a B.B. King riff.
Yeah.
But it was specifically about the movie Into the Night with Jeff Goldblum. And it's got a bunch of B.B. King songs on it. I think that's why the writer kind of found a reason to write about this. But they write about this thing called the Yuppie Nightmare Cycle.
Mm.
And they reference Into the Night, After Hours, and a couple other films. But that is a very real trope in 80s films. Trading Places.
Yeah.
Another one of those. Like, you know, I've got everything I need. What can go wrong? And then swapped places, you know, Eddie Murphy. There's a bunch of those movies, and it's such a weird kind of just like overlooked genre, like subgenre of films. And I'm fascinated by it because, yeah, it's this idea that I have it all and everything is okay. I mean, in the Dietz's case in this movie, it's like, we're going to get away to the country and everything's going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of like plays hand in hand with the idea of getting away from the cities and going to the suburbs.
Yeah.
You know, like we're just going to go and not going to have to worry about crime, not going to have to worry about this, not going to have to. Dude, you can't run away from anything.
Yeah.
It's always going to haunt you. And I think that's a really big, you know, not just yuppie movies about yuppies, but you find that in a lot of movies in the 1980s.
Yeah.
Whether it was meant to be that way or not, it's just very noticeable.
But it's sort of just like that's where the cultural producers of the time were just experiencing that anxiety, right? Like it's like, especially, you know, economic downturn of the 70s. And then suddenly like for a number of people, they had access again. Like, and it was like, oh yeah, I've got the life that I was hoping for, that I was promised for a certain subset of people. Right. And then it's like, well, now I'm fearful that this is going to be taken away from me because I can see like they're literally living next to the economic deprivation. They're like, oh no, there's no way that I can like survive this if I know that it's right next to me.
Yeah. And it's like, it's kind of a thing where they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to bring anything up. You know, Beetlejuice, you know, they get right to it pretty fast where, you know, they have this, you know, the parents get, I don't know what you would say, like when Beetlejuice turns into a snake. You know, like it kind of like hits them really fast. Like they can't deny it after that. And then they're having the seance and trying to exorcise the Maitlands. But a lot of these other movies, there's just sort of this like cognitive dissonance, like where the characters are just sort of like, it takes them a while to sort of just fess up to the fact, if they do, that things are not right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I guess to their credit in Beetlejuice, I don't know if they I don't know how much things change. Again, like Winona Ryder not being goth anymore is definitely some sort of signifier.
But, yeah, it's curious. But I mean, it's like interesting because she's no longer like dressing goth and doesn't seem to have like the attendant depression that she had before. But at the end of the movie, she is like still in communication with the Maitlands as ghost, and like they're kind of raising her as well. And it's like one of her reward for getting an A on her math test is that like she gets to be floating and doing the Harry Belafonte song. So it's like it's part of her gothness is like subsumed into like the idyllic life.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, after the I guess it's a wedding. I don't know. I guess the almost wedding, whatever you want to call it. The Dietzes smile at the Maitlands. So obviously, maybe now they're weird.
Yeah.
There's obviously like a lot of like you really have to sort of there's a lot of like stuff you have to sort of let go of, like, I'm pretty sure Beetlejuice kills Robert Goulet and his wife.
Yeah.
And that's sort of like, okay, well, now you're living in a house where there was a murder. I mean, there's a lot of stuff you sort of have to, I think, look past and just be like, you know what, it's a movie. Suspension of disbelief, all that kind of stuff. But it's definitely, I think you're not meant to sort of like overthink it too much, but that's the thing with movies. It's like you put something into the world and people have to overthink these things for them in order for them to sort of survive and kind of keep being relevant in some way or another.
And you, do you, Lydia, take this man
to be out?
She's a little bit nervous. Maybe I should answer for her, okay?
I'm Lydia Dietz, and I'm of sound mind. The man next to me is the one I want. You ask me, I'm answering. Yes, I love that man of mine.
There's the movie, and, like, it can be just as weird and odd and all of these things, but, like, my interest is, like, what produces all of that? And I'm like, so what are you drawing from? Where's the thing that, like, makes this thing weird or odd or, like, you know, gets the filmmaker down this sort of rabbit hole of creating this, like, immersive experience for us? Like, where does that come from? And I think, like, with Beetlejuice, it just felt very much like, you know, in line with all of those 80s films about yuppies that are just like, I'm so afraid of all of this. And it tries to make light of it, but really it's sort of saying, like, in a way it feels like it's like, no, the worst of the worst, absolutely got to get rid of those. Beetlejuice can't stand, right? Like, we just have to get rid of him. But they're like little things. Like, if we embrace a little bit of weirdness, don't worry, it'll be fine. If we, like, you know, co-opt some of the weirdness, then we can eliminate the threat of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I'm always searching for, like, the deeper meaning, especially in movies. Like, movies more than anything. And, you know, obviously I have, I've loved Beetlejuice for a long time. I watched it as a kid.
Yeah.
You know, long before I'd read any, long before I even knew what criticism was, you know, long before I picked up any collection by any famous author to try to dig deeper into, like, books or movies or whatever. But the fact that it has stayed with me for this long and I'm still kind of searching and, like, kind of like taking stuff from that, like looking for meaning in it, I think kind of says to me, at least for me. And I think that's the kind of thing I'm always looking for in a movie. And, you know, I've written about this a little bit, but, like, another movie from that era, and I mentioned Freddy Krueger earlier, but Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, that's a movie about, it's kind of the same thing. It's like the parents murdered this terrible man. And they just thought they could sweep it under the rug. And then he comes back and he starts killing their kids. You know, there are so many movies, especially in the 80s, where that is a theme. It's just like, what are we, you know, this stuff's going to come back and bite us in the butt sooner or later.
Yeah.
And it really should have told us, I think, you know, now 30 years later, we should have paid attention.
Yeah. Jason, what's one lasting image that sticks with you from Beetlejuice?
So, Winona Ryder is probably my first real crush. It could be her, but at the end of the day, I've kind of come around to realize that I am such a Catherine O'Hara person. That it is the scene where she is trapped by one of her own statues. And she's yelling, "This is my art and it is dangerous." She's just so perfect. Just a complete icon, in every way, shape, or form. But yeah. I think it's that. I think it's her being trapped by her own art is just such a good metaphor. So
amazing. Jason, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is great.